So you mentioned alpelisib and particularly some of the unusual toxicities that are seen, the diarrhea, the infections. Can you kind of go through what we know about alpelisib, both in terms of efficacy but also tolerability in CLL? And then we'll maybe talk a little bit about FL as well, but just starting out with CLL.
So there have been two pivotal trials, randomized phase III trials in CLL. One was a comparison of single agent. Actually, I take it back, there have been three. Single agent rituximab versus rituximab plus idelalisib. A very similar study of ofatumumab versus ofatumumab plus idelalisib. These were for very, very frail patients. Frequently, I get a lot of questions, how could you give a CLL patient single agent rituximab? But these patients were allowed to go on study with grade 3 thrombocytopenia, marked anemia. They were really not suitable for further chemotherapy. So these are the patients who, in the real world, and we know this from surveys with clinicians as well as marketing data, that this is used in these really frail, advanced CLL patients. And in that study, the combination of rituximab plus idelalisib versus rituximab resulted in a substantial improvement in progression-free survival and a very significant improvement in overall survival. And given this improvement in both progression-free and overall survival, it got approval. In the ofatumumab study, there was a very substantial improvement in progression-free survival. There was a trend to an overall survival advantage, but it did not meet a statistical endpoint. And then I had the opportunity to lead a study comparing bendamustine and rituximab to bendamustine, rituximab plus idelalisib. Again, a lot of people ask why we did that study, but you have to remember that study started when the standard of care for relapsed disease was bendamustine, rituximab, and this was a can you beat them question. And so we compared these two. The median progression-free survival was 23 months, and there was an overall survival difference in advantage in favor of the idelalisib combination, despite the higher risk of infection that was seen in the triple combination. Now, a lot of people ask me, well, do you really need the bendamustine? And unfortunately, the study really wasn't designed to ask that question. It could have had a third arm that was just idelalisib plus rituximab without the benda to ask that question, but unfortunately, it didn't. However, if you do the unholy cross-trial comparison of rituximab idelalisib and then the rituximab benda idelalisib, well, you have a 21-month progression-free survival in the idela plus rituximab. So my conclusion, personally, even though this is my own study, I'm not so sure that the bendamustine is essential in this combination. I think that if you're going to use BR, you should either add a targeted agent, either idelalisib or ibrutinib, because the Helios trial also had very similar results, or you just use rituximab and idelalisib alone and forget giving the bendamustine, and there'll be less toxicity associated with it.
Could you talk a little bit more about the toxicity, when it occurs, how it appears clinically, and what you think the mechanism is? And maybe we can focus on, I guess, the diarrhea and the infections.
Well, so we see one of the early toxicities is a transaminitis. This seems to be immune-mediated. It's often in the heavily pretreated patient. This is a transient phenomenon, frequently never gets to grade 3, but if it does, you can discontinue drug for a short time, wait until the transaminases go to grade 0 or 1, and then you can resume the drug and often never see the transaminitis again. One of the reasons we think that this is associated with fitness of the immune state is both Jen Brown in the young patient and myself in the older patient did a combination, a study of idelalisib as a monotherapy, and we found that there was an age-related phenomenon. The younger you were, i.e., the more fit your immune system was, the more likely you were to have a serious transaminitis. Now, The other toxicity, and this tends to occur quite early within the first 3 to 6 weeks. The diarrhea is a little different. It tends to occur in two different forms. The first form is very much like ibrutinib diarrhea. It's early on, occurring within the first few weeks of treatment, and will typically respond to motility agents such as loperamide and will resolve and tends to not recur. Then at a median of about 7 months, we see the development of a more serious diarrhea in about 13 to 15% of patients. And sometimes this presents as sudden, copious, watery diarrhea. Other times it gradually increases over time, which is why it's really important to make sure that the patients are reporting diarrhea to you when you use this agent so that you can intervene early. This late diarrhea early on, we weren't sure what the cause was, so we did a bunch of colonoscopies, and the colonoscopy showed a lymphocytic colitis. So again, an immune-mediated phenomenon, and this was a T-cell lymphocytic colitis, as all lymphocytic colitis is. It's steroid responsive. Patients who have the severe form, you know, with grade 3 diarrhea are admitted to the hospital. They're started on systemic steroids. If it starts more slowly, you can often treat patients with budesonide, which is a non-absorbable oral steroid, which is effective in colitis. And again, the severity of the diarrhea determines whether you're going to use budesonide as an outpatient or hydration and systemic steroids as an inpatient. Either way, when this diarrhea develops, you discontinue the drug, you put it on a hold. If the patients respond and the diarrhea resolves, about half of patients will be able to resume without recurrence of the diarrhea. So just because you develop the colitis doesn't mean that you can't use the drug anymore in these patients. The patients can be rechallenged, and about half will get away with it. And then one of the other areas that we've seen is this increased risk of infection. There were some reports of increased PJP, but with appropriate prophylaxis for PJP, that can be dealt with. We also see reactivation of CMV, and you don't have to do CMV viral loads on a regular basis, but you do have to watch the patient, and if they start to develop clinical manifestations of CMV, they need to be evaluated for CMV. Again, CMV reactivation, we would discontinue the drug until the infection is under control. Now, interestingly, with these drug interruptions that occur with the diarrhea, with the CMV reactivation, frequently they can be prolonged, measured in weeks, and we don't always see rapid progression of the disease during these drug holidays, suggesting that maybe daily dosing isn't the right way to go. But of course, I can't tell you what the right dosing schedule is. We have copanlisib, which is an IV inhibitor. It's a pan-PI3 kinase, but really alpha-delta. And you get efficacy with that agent given IV once a week. So 3 weeks out of four. So it may be that we're overdosing patients with the PI3 kinase inhibitors on a daily basis, that we don't need that sustained inhibition.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah, and you asked, what is the mechanism? Well, we think it's T-cell mediated. Remember, PI3 kinase is a critical pathway in T-cells as well. And if you hit PI3 kinase in T-cells, you're going to suppress Tregs more than other T-cell subsets. And obviously, suppression of Tregs is going to, unfortunately, have consequences for immune-mediated phenomenon. The $64,000 question, of course, is there a way we can push on the B-cell and treat for 3 days out of 7 or 5 days out of 20 or something like that, and let the T cells recover and avoid the toxicity? These are all speculative. We don't know. And obviously, I think a lot more needs to be done on dosing of this entire class of drugs.